History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we'll take a little initiative to ask a few questions and, more importantly, take the time to patiently listen to what comes back our way. Our perspective might just change. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. So often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I am in rural Fresno, California, out in the middle of a bunch of grapevines, currant vines, and I'm sitting with 97-year-old Doug Johnson. We're going to hear what he was up to in World War II and since. But Doug, let's go way back. You grew up in Southern California during the Great Depression. What do you remember about those growing up years? You had an older sister and a younger sister, right?
My father was an architect, and he worked for Lowe's Pantages Corporation. He was salaried prior to 1924 at $80,000 a year, and that was a lot of money back then.
That's a lot of money in the 20s.
A lot of money back then. He was one of the leading architects for the Lowe's Pantages Corporation, which wound up to be Warner Brothers.
Uh-huh.
He did a lot of theaters. He did the part of the theater in Fresno.
The Warner's Theater?
Warner's Theater. He was supervised construction when they were in their final stage. My grandfather was a sculptor, and he was also employed by MGM, and he did the lions that MGM, sculpted the lions that MGM had on their entry. So I was from a family of sculptors. My grandfather was also a musician. My dad, we had a big Nash touring car, as I can recall. And when the Depression hit, my dad, being he was one of the top-notch employees at Lowe's Pantages, was given a job as chauffeur running a LaSalle touring car for the elite coming out of the East Coast to see Hollywood. So he did that along with drafting. He worked for different architectural firms in L.A. too, kind of on the side. And I can remember him sitting at his drafting board in our house. He was a chain smoker cigarette, and he'd have a cigarette in the ashtray, full-length cigarette in the ashtray, smoldering. He'd take one puff on it, put it back down again, continue drafting, get ready to take another puff, and it was all ashes, so he'd light another cigarette. So we lived in a house full of smoke. It didn't seem to bother anybody. My sister was 4 years older than I was, and my younger sister was 6 years younger. My dad continued working there and did the mortuary at Santa Paula. The mortuary was designed as a mission. By that design, my dad was wanted quite a bit and had seven mortuaries to design, and then the war broke out. So he came up here and went to work for PG&E as a draftsman, and he did the architectural work on the homes at Bass Lake that they have for retired PG&E employees. He also eventually went into business for himself, and then was a building contractor. He held a license not as an architect because he was from London. He had his citizenship papers, but at that time he could not get a license. When I got out of the service, I did work with him, and Johnson & Johnson was the architectural firm or building firm. I built a dairy at Madeira. I built the clothing store for Long's up in Chowchilla. Then I built the theater at Biola.
Which is still standing. You can drive right past it.
Still there.
I want to ask you about that childhood, and maybe there's something here, maybe not, but you mentioned when the Depression hit, your dad becoming the chauffeur for the company in that LaSalle touring car. Did he ever have a take his son to work day? Did you ever get to ride along in there?
No, not really, because all the women, usually it was women. And I can remember, I think it was 1933, we lived on Clinton in Los Angeles, and the earthquake hit. We were in a two-story apartment, and my dad got us all down on the ground floor and out into the parking lot, and we were watching the transformers swinging back and forth on the power poles.
Wow.
And so we ran through that earthquake, and then everything was chaotic from then on. My dad and mother went on welfare because everything shut down, you know, during that time. Mm. So the government came in and ran a food program, and you get a shopping bag full of food, you know. So I can remember that. My grandmother was all part of the same group. The days of being raised during the Depression where I had to do everything on my own. If I wanted any money, I sold magazines. I got a few pennies, Lady Holmes Journal, Saturday Evening Post, you name it. I sold one door-to-door selling magazines, a nickel apiece at that time. I went to Hollywood. I graduated from a junior high school and went to Hollywood High School in the 10th grade. And Hollywood High School border was Waring Avenue, which is the entrance to the RKO studio. And they moved the district from Waring out away from us, and I had to go to Fairfax. So I went to Fairfax in the second half of the 10th grade and finished at Fairfax High School.
And a couple other things come to mind. A lot of people are excited that the Olympics are coming back to Los Angeles, and some of us remember the Olympics there in 1984, but weren't they there in 1932 also?
Well, they were, but when I used to be a kid with my dad, he took us down to Exposition Park, and there was a soccer field, and it was international soccer played there all the time. And my dad, being from Scotland and England, the Scottish teams were there quite often playing soccer. And I remember going down there, but I don't remember the Coliseum.
I'm curious if you remember, as a young man, and certainly the Depression and what your family's going through is coloring your perspective, but do you remember having a dream, an ambition of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
No, not really. When I was 13, I was peddling Hollywood Citizen News. I made about $4 a month. And at that time, Gordon Varney, the model railroad man from England, opened a store on Melrose. And being 13 years old and loving to see trains, I had a Lionel of my own, but loving to see trains, I used to go down and watch him run his trains around there. And Gordon Varney finally put up with me, I guess, enough, and he said, would you like to own an engine? And I said, oh, I'd love to have an engine. He says, can you pay for it? And it's $5. I said, no, I can't pay for it. I work for the paper. And he says, what can you pay? I said, about 50 cents a week. He says, if you can pay 50 cents a week, here's the engine and here's some track. So that's how I got started in Model Railroad in 1936.
Uh-huh.
And I have a layout now that's 9 feet wide and 16 feet long. So it's one of the largest layouts, I'm told, here in California.
So you finish at Fairfax High School. You graduate 1941?
Actually, in January 1942.
So something happened before that. Something happened your senior year that was pretty significant in the world. December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you heard about what happened there?
Well, I was riding my bicycle, I remember, and I went by a building, and people were out running, hollering, there's a war, there's a war. And it didn't mean anything to me. At that age, it didn't ring a bell. And when I got home, my folks were telling me all about what had happened at Pearl Harbor. But at school, even in high school, we didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Mm-hmm. You know, we had no idea it was in the Hawaiian Islands. And so the school then was all Pearl Harbor. Everything was all Pearl Harbor. And we learned about Pearl Harbor and the war. We were in the beginning of the Liberty ships and the airplanes that were flying. You know, prior to that, we had two Zeppelins, big Zeppelins, the Grafsby and the Macon. They used to fly over Los Angeles all the time. And they grounded them during the war, although I understand they did use them for observation. You know, those are two of the biggest dirigibles ever built in this country.
You know, and I've talked to some folks who were around Southern California during that time right after Pearl Harbor, and some of them have shared this concern that, hey, the Japanese are going to come to the Southern California coastline. And I've heard stories of, you know, air raid wardens and spotlights at night lighting up the sky or imposed blackouts so you wouldn't be a target for bombers. Did you see life changing in any ways like that where you were?
No, we lived on Waring Avenue. The alley in the back, I had a Model T. Somebody gave me a Model T. And this Japanese fella at that time came by and bought it from me for $15. they came and got it. And at the end of the alley was the Japanese family. But they were well liked by everybody in town, so nobody ever paid any attention to the Japanese people where I lived. They were all well thought of. They were very ingenious people. They had a big garden behind their house and used to give vegetables and carrots and different things to different neighbors. So nobody had anything against the Japanese that I can remember.
You were probably up here by the time they started rounding them up and sending them to the camps, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I believe so, but I lived on a farm. I worked on the farm with my brother-in-law. They gave me credit in high school for working on the farm.
Oh, really?
So in 1939, I only went to 3 classes in high school.
You came up here and were working in the Fresno area?
All during the summer, and then I'd work on in to harvest up here, and we'd go back down to school. And Dieter was the principal, and he called me into his office, and he said, "You are not going to graduate this year." And I said, "Why am I not going to graduate?" And he said, "You've only been to 3 classes." And I said, "Well, I was excused from the classes." He said, "Not by this office." And I said, "Well, you're not going to let me graduate?" And he said, "No." And I said, "I'll tell you what, I'm in charge of the stage crew. The extravaganza is supposed to be put on." And I said, "I'm in charge of the stage crew and all the workers, and we're not going to put on the extravaganza." And I was only 17 years old at that time. And they finally came over and they said, "We'll let you graduate." So I did graduate, but I only got 3 classes on my report card.
I never heard a story quite like that. And what kind of work were you doing up here on the farm?
We irrigated cotton. I ran all the tractors. I ran a Massey Harris, Farmall, F-12, RC Case, milk cows. We had hogs. We had cotton, and we had alfalfa. And in the alfalfa, in those old days, we had more Johnson grass than we had alfalfa, but we still mowed hay. I ran the baler. We had an International Harvester baler, and I ran the baler. And at that time, we walked alongside the baler and poked the wires through a three-wire baler. And I developed a seat on each side that I could sit in and push the wires and have to walk. So we baled hay not only on our ranch, but on Mr. Benson's ranch or anybody else. We could earn extra money, my brother-in-law. We towed the baler with a 1924 Dodge truck.
But at this time, and you mentioned, you know, right after Pearl Harbor, everything was Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor. And I'm sure you knew that other guys your age were starting to go in the service. Was there a thought in your mind that at some point you were going to be involved in this war?
No, I tried to get in at that time, but I didn't go to school here, so I didn't know anybody my age in around here. And the two boys that I knew, Mr. Benson's son, Chuck Benson, and a Bean boy, we were the two boys, and we were friends, the three of us. They were all involved in farming. The Bean boys worked for their dad, and Charles worked for his father, and I worked for my brother-in-law. So we were all preoccupied. As a matter of fact, the radio and the war didn't mean anything to us. We weren't involved. The radio at that time didn't do much. They had an enlistment deal, and I went in there, and I was told, "You're deferred for as a strategic person in farming, and they need farmers more than they need soldiers." So we stayed there.
And did you say you tried to get into the Army Air Corps at one point?
At one time, yeah.
Were you thinking you wanted to be a pilot, or?
No, as a mechanic. I loved mechanic work. I did all the mechanic work on the farm. I had an old Fordson tractor that I rebuilt. I used the Fordson tractor in order to scrape with the Fordson tractor. We doubled the wheels, the big steel wheels on the back. Instead of one set of wheels, we had doubles on each side, and we'd tear the ground up with that tractor and then come in with our Case tractor and level the ground and put our chicks in for alfalfa. So it was just a continuous farming operation.
Well, it sounds like it, and we certainly understand why that was strategically important. You need to be able to feed all these soldiers overseas, not to mention the people in America. But so when you tried to get into the service, was that because you wanted off the farm, or what was your motivation for trying to enlist?
I just liked being a mechanic. And I wasn't doing enough mechanical work on the farm, and my brother-in-law and I didn't get along real great. We did get along partially, but he didn't do anything at all. He was not a worker, and in those days, we would take bicycle tires, which were inflatable at that time, and cut them in thirds. And that would be a half moon for each third of the tire. And we use those for siphons. and irrigating. Then if you could had the money, you would buy boiler tubing, 1¼-inch boiler tubing, and use that. But the problem with boiler tubing was so heavy, you could only carry about 5 at a time. We use rubber tires more than anything.
You mean they don't do that anymore around here?
I don't think anybody could set a siphon anymore down there.
So you're working here on the farm. You've tried to get into the service.
I was told that you can't, you're classified. That kind of ended me right there. I went to Fresno State College in 1942, and by the draft board, I was told if I took 3 agricultural classes, I would be accepted going to school learning agriculture. So I went to Fresno State College. At that time, I was on McKinley, and I went to, and I took dairy products, ag survey, and viticulture. The dairy products class, where there were 6 of us, and I furnished the milk. The teacher was studying to be have his master's degree, and he gave me the dairy book, and he said, read chapter 1, and then you teach chapter 1, and I'll be in the office. So chapter 2, chapter 3 would come up, and I would teach each chapter on how to do the Babcock test and all the other things. And I still have some of the glasses out there in the shop from testing.
And you were supposed to be a student.
I was a student.
But you end up teaching the class.
I got teaching the class. I got an A in that. And in viticulture, John Benson had vineyard, and he taught me how to prune. And then when I had the class pruning, we had the same 6 kids in viticulture and maybe a couple more, but they didn't know how to prune. So I taught them how to prune, and the instructor, O.M. Brower, he didn't know anything at all about viticulture. So I got an A in viticulture. And then the ag survey was, we were given by Sisk, who was the congressman at that time, a complete set of agriculture books. There were probably 12 of them. And by owning those books, that made me in charge of ag survey. And I got an A in that. So I graduated with 3 A's. And I was called into the office and told that I had to take English and PE and history. And I said, well, the draft board will only let me take the 3 classes. They said, this is a teaching college. You cannot continue here unless you take these other classes. They called the draft board, and the draft board said no. So they released me from school. So I wound up with 3 classes that I have on my record. At Fresno State in 1942.
Never went back.
No, and I 1940 worked on the farm, and then 1944 I was in the service. I couldn't go back. I couldn't get released from the draft board anyway.
You mentioned something there that you had learned how to prune, and then you're a student in this class. You end up teaching everybody else in the class how to prune the vines. Is there a simple overview of that, that for a layman like me or the people listening, that you would say what the key to correctly pruning a grapevine would be?
Well, depending on the vines, we had Thompson seedless in there at Fresno State, and you leave your canes 3 or 4 feet long. You prune from 4 to 6 canes per vine. You tie them on the wire at that point in time. We had 3 wires, top wire, middle wire, bottom wire. Then they changed over to putting 3 wires horizontal instead of vertical. And then I showed them how to wrap the canes around the wire, and then we took care of the vines accordingly.
How old are the vines you have out here?
1947, they were planted by Kenny Seibert. I don't like to say it, but we're kind of exotic farmers here. We farm entirely different from a nutrient value. We go in with potassium and calcium 4 to 5 times in spray during the growing season. The potassium puts sugar into the fruit. The calcium hardens the skins on the fruit. So we wind up with a larger berry than if you're farming plain Zante currants. We are probably one of the last hand-picked Zante currants. Everybody has gone to machine harvest. And the difference between machine harvest is they're picked later, they're harvested later, and they don't have the quality or the meat, the body in the raisins, the berry that we have. We have a total of 10,314 vines here. We farm them, and we're on top of the line of producing and quality.
But before Doug Johnson could grow all those raisins, he had to get home from World War II. We'll hear more about his unique contributions to the war effort, what put him in the hospital in the Philippines, and the photo he had in his locker overseas that means even more to him today than it did then. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down. 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at ProvidentPayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 97-year-old Doug Johnson of Fresno, California, farmer, builder, inventor, and Navy veteran of World War II. We're going to hear what he was up to in the Philippines during the war, but first, a little more about the special variety of raisins that he and his wife, Mary Ann, grow here in an area quite famous for raisins.
Some people don't even know there are more than one kind of raisin, right?
Not
they
true.
Just think a raisin's a raisin when there's so many umpteen varieties of them. So what makes your variety so special?
The Zante currant is a raisin grown in Greece in the 3rd century. It was the only raisin Greece and Armenia and Turkey were the three countries that grew raisins for Europe. There was no United States at that time. And my mother later in years worked in a bakery for folks at a bakery, and the raisins they used were Zante currants, because the Zante currant now is 1/3 the size of a Thompson's berry. So if you're baking a cookie, the flavor on the Zante currants is the same as the Thompson, but you put 3 Zantes in a cookie and you can only put 1 Thompson. If you cut a Thompson raisin to make 3 out of it, then it breaks the skin and the sugar leaks into the cookie and the cookie becomes soft. So the Zante currants are a baker's raisin. The bakers here prefer them if they can find them, but it only takes certain bakers. Uh-huh. A lot of these big bakers are not interested in quality. They want quantity.
Well, everybody listening has probably tasted one of yours at some point. They just didn't realize
And no, but I've talked to many people that have no idea what a Zante currant is.
So you're educating us
and
today.
Even people in the agricultural field, you say, I grow grapes, and what kind of grapes you got? You know, a Zante currant. What do you mean, Zante currant? The technical name is black Corinth.
All right.
And the reason it's black Corinth is the Corinth is the estuary between upper and lower Greece. There's a bay, and that's called the Bay of Corinth. There's an island off of the southern half of Greece where the Zante currants were growing.
So it kind of sounds like your operation, and you've been in this home and this vineyard for 65 years. It sounds like it's pretty unique what you do with that variety.
Well, we have been told we were the largest organic grower in the world right here on this 20 acres. Our production is 2.5 ton per acre, when the average is about 1.5 tons per acre. But the only secret that we have is nutrition. If you look at this vineyard here, there's not a weed on the ground. I developed a tool about 25 years ago that would go in and take the grass out from under the vines and not disturb the vines. The poleweed is the biggest weed, and it would grow past the height of the vines, ragweed, and all the mustard grass and everything else. And by using the tool that we developed, we get rid of all that. As of now, 20 acres, there is not one blade of grass out there.
That's impressive. I got to go take a look. Well, you could tell me a million more stories about this, and it's fascinating. I'm impressed just to hear, you know, all the ingenuity that you've brought to your life as a builder, as a farmer. But so many of these memories you wouldn't have if you didn't come home from overseas during World War II. And we kind of left off the government saying, no, we can't take you into the military. We need you strategically in this farming operation. But eventually that changed. Eventually you went overseas with the Navy. So how did that come about?
When I went into Fresno, they had a pile of draft paper, and we went up to San Francisco. And my paper was in the stack, all U.S. Army. They told me there, your papers are in the Army. If you're trying to get in the Navy, you aren't going to get in the Navy. So there was an ensign sitting over at the desk, and I walked over to him, and I said, I got a question for you. And then Wave, one of the girls, came over and said, you cannot talk to him. And I said, now, wait a minute, lady. I said, I'm a civilian. I can talk to anybody I can. Well, please, you know. He said, what's your problem? And I said, well, my grandfather was a sea captain. And I said, I'm the oldest grandson. And I said, you think he wouldn't roll over in his grave if he knew that his grandson was going to go into the Army? And the guy said, just a minute, he went over and pulled my paper out of that stack, handed me the paper. He says, get in that station and get the hell out of here. And that's how I got in the Navy. So BS pays.
Or your grandfather changed your life. He didn't even know it.
Yeah, and down in San Diego, there was 120 of us in the company. We were all lined up outside the first day. And the guy says, anybody that had gone to college, I don't care how long it was, and military school or had any type of military training, step forward. Well, there were four of us, and I stepped forward, and there were two boys there that went through military school. So the chief in charge of the company says, okay, I'm going to give you a command. So I want you to go right face, left face, about face, and parade rest. He got to the first boy that was from military school, and the kid, whoop, hey, you know, and you couldn't understand a word he said, you know. And the other one was basically the same. When he got to me, I just said, right face, you know, or left face, or about face, and everybody worked. And the chief says, where did you get a voice like that? And I says, calling hogs.
Calling hogs.
He says, okay, Johnson. He says, you're chief petty officer in charge of the company. So I had a chief petty officer patch on my uniform. And I call cadence, you know, right lip, you know, all in command. And we would walk from our barracks and through the grinder out to the mess hall. And they said when our company would come in, they said Johnson's voice was so loud that he overrode all the other commands. So they said, when Johnson comes in, we'll stop giving the command, let him give the command. So I commanded about three companies at a time just by my loud voice. And then I was selected as a teacher for the next bunch came in, and I didn't like that. I didn't know what everybody thought of those guys, and I didn't like it. So I was playing handball. I'd gone to the school, and I was playing handball, and I turned my ankle. They said, how bad's your ankle? And I said, oh, it's real bad. I can't walk. And at that time, we were learning Marine cadence marching. And he says, wait a couple of days to see how it turns out. Well, I made it worse. You know, I told them it was really bad. So they sent me over to medics, and medics put a gauze around my foot and put me on limited duty. And they booted me out of the school because I couldn't march. And then my name came up on the draft, and the draft was looking for electricians. I knew electricity. I had no problem with electricity. So they sent me to electrical school in Mississippi, Gulfport, Mississippi. And I went to school there for 4 months. Out of 120, I wound up 41st in the class. They took 40 of the class and moved them into ABSD, Advanced Base Supply Depot. So I was 41, and I didn't go. I came home on leave, and I got a telegram on leave report to San Diego, you're now ABSD. So the one guy got sick or something happened, and they needed 40, and I replaced him. And we went through amphibious training at Coronado Beach, handling the rifle. We were on landing craft vehicle and personnel. We'd hit the beach, and we'd go out one to the right, one to the left, one to the middle, one to the right, one to the left, one to the middle, and we'd peel off. And our job was taking a banner, a pole with a flag on it, and go under the ground and stick it in the ground and unfurl the flag. And if we could, put two poles in, and it had the initial 1, 2, 3, or whatever. And that was the invasion of Japan for the LSTs to land. And they would see the big A or B or whatever it was. So that was our job. And it was going in with the first wave of the Marine Corps and no guns, just the banners. So it was really, I'd call it a suicide mission, I guess.
Yeah, so you guys, if there had been an invasion of mainland Japan, you guys in this ABSD, Advanced Base Supply Depot, you would be going in on these Higgins boats, these LCVPs,
right,
and planting those flags so the folks coming behind you would know where they were supposed to go.
Right.
So this is what you're preparing for. There's going to be
this
an invasion of Japan, and this is how it's going to go.
2 months of training at Coronado Beach.
Uh-huh.
And then we were assigned a ship and went overseas, and it was the MS Daystar. It was a Dutch merchant ship. It was the MS Daystar, and because everybody had diarrhea, we called it the MS Dysentery.
Well, that ship's wake would be easy to see, I guess.
Yeah, and my job, because I was part of this ABSD, was to stand guard duty on the hatch. And the stairway went up to a landing, and then you stood at the landing. There was a curtain. A person would come up through the curtain, close the curtain, and you were standing in that square, black. No, you couldn't see anything. Then you opened the curtain to the outside of the ship, let them get out, close that curtain, made sure that no light got in or out. So then I remember one time I was on duty, and a guy came up the stairway, and he was seasick, and he vomited all over me.
Mm.
And so he and I ran through the side of the ship and puked our guts out over the side of the ship. We didn't worry about the curtain.
So much for that.
And then I finally went back in, got overseas. I wasn't seasick, but I was sure stunk. Anyway, we pulled into Hawaii and stayed outside the edge of Pearl Harbor, and then went over to Aniwetok. We were chased by a submarine, and we had a destroyer escort, DE watch overs. There's three ships, and it took us into Aniwetok. And as you went in the corridor, you'd look over the side of the ship, and there are all these sunken ships down in the water as clear as a bell. All these sunken ships. And we stayed there until they gave us the all clear, and then we left. We were there a couple of 3 days, I guess. Then we left and went right straight through to Leyte.
Was that kind of sobering, to see all those sunken ships?
I don't know. You had a different attitude. All the training that we'd gone through, you know, it's kind of, if your time was up, your time was up. That's all. I think that's the attitude nearly everybody had in the service. If your time's up, your time's up, you know.
Mm.
And I don't really know of all the guys that I knew ever worried about getting shot. I was never in a combat area. I was in the cranes. I operated the biggest crane they had in the Navy at Subic Bay. 100 of us were lined up. Chief came and said, can anybody run a motor grader, a bulldozer, or anything like that? And I held my hand up and took a step forward.
Mm-hmm.
He said, go down to heavy equipment. I went down to heavy equipment. There was a chief, petty officer, and he said, you're off the farm. And I said, yes. And there were no sirs at that time because the guys were just enlisted men like myself. Anyway, I said, yes, I from the farm. He said, there's a road driller up on about there, been there about 10 weeks, the CB's left. And he says, go see what you can do, see if you can find out how to run that. And I went up and opened the hood, and there was the engine and the thing off of a CC case, which I happen to own at home. So I started the motor. The motor started real good, and I went in, and it was a hand clutch. And I pulled the clutch back, and it came all the way back to zero. So I turned the tractor off, and I pulled the plate off the side and adjusted the throwout bearing. It had a pin, and you turned it, and I adjusted the throwout bearing and got it going and started the tractor up and drove it back down to the tent, which was our headquarters. And the chief says, how'd you get that started? And I said, an old case tractor. And he says, I'll be damned. He says, you see that big crane over there? And I says, yes, sir. And he says, you think you can run it? I says, I don't know. I had never run a crane in my life, you know. He says, go try it. So they took me over in a Jeep, and I climbed up in there and started a big Cat D8 engine in it. And I pulled the levers back and swung the cab around. I raised and lowered the boom, and raised and lowered the hook. And he said, you seem like you know what you're doing. And I said, well, it's simple enough. I said, it's no different than a grader, you know. So he said, okay, this is your crane. It was the largest crane the Navy had in the Philippines. The crane weighed 68 tons.
Ooh.
It had a 50-ton lifting capacity, and my job was loading and unloading whatever they brought in cargo nets from the LSTs were in the bay. Their LSTs would take cargo nets from their hold and put them in LCVPs. Those would go onto the beach, drop their amphibious anchor out in the bay, and then come on and then drop the ramp down. And our P&H cranes would climb into the LCVP and pick up the cargo nets and swing them around and lower them into 10-wheeler trucks.
Hmm.
The trucks then came off of the beach up to where I was parked up on the shore, and then I would offload them into other trucks or whatever they're going to do with them. Our area of material that we had was 35 feet high. My crane could actually pick up nearly 75 feet, but with a cargo net, I was only about 50 feet up. So we would release the cargo net and dump everything out of the cargo net, regardless of what it was, on top of the heap. And then it would roll down to about 35 feet wide at the bottom and about 70 feet at the top.
It's a big pile.
And that ran a mile and a half long.
Wow.
And the way they did that, off of the material that we had hand-laid tracks. And they were only about a foot wide, and on those were hand carts, flat-decked hand carts. And the Filipinos, one, two, or three, whatever, worked together, would take an item out of the stack, put it on the cart, and it had a code name. And the one code name I remember was Ron 73, that was the submarines. And they would push that all the way down, and this was maybe half a mile by hand, and there would be Ron 73s, and they picked the cart up, pivoted on, go on the railroad tracks, and then dump that over on Ron 73. Also had areas for PT boats. They had Philippine mahogany material for Philippine boats. We had all kinds of stuff in there, and then the other stuff were for invasions went off to the left side. So the right side was everything that was dental chairs, you name it. I don't care what it was. Ham radio, all kinds of equipment went down that deal. So I was ordered our pier. We had a dwarf one out, had 50-ton capacity. And my crane was running towards the base of the pier, because sometimes I had to pick up heavier stuff. And a Jeep came up with a captain, and he got off and he said, I want this crane out here. We got some material to take off. And I said, sir, I can't take this crane down there. He said, you're being ordered to take it down there. I said, I don't mean to disobey your order, but I can't take a 68-ton crane on a 50-ton capacity pier. I'll go right through it. And he got huffed up, jumped in the Jeep, and he went back, and the old man came down, commander, and he pulled up to me, and he says, Doug, were you disrespectful? I said, no, sir. He says, I just told him you can't take a 68-ton crane on a 50-ton pier. I didn't take much thought to do that. He said, thank you. And he says, go ahead. And I left. So other than that, I got to refuse a captain captain's order.
Clearly, you had a pretty good reason to do so. It is break time again, but there's more to come with 97-year-old Doug Johnson. You might not believe the story of how he and his wife of 73 years, Mary Ann, got together. Find photos and a short video with the Johnsons at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a reminder that there were so many different ways to contribute to the Allied victory in World War II. In the case of Doug Johnson, it was operating a crane nicknamed the Wild One in the Philippines.
So you guys, I mean, what you're doing there is key to the whole effort. The logistics that you guys are carrying out are the difference between a ship, a squadron of PT boats, submarines, whatever. The difference between them having what they need or not, right, is what you guys
supply.
Were doing there?
We're a supply base.
Yeah.
And NSD, Naval Supply Depot.
And how long were those days? How many hours in a row would you be operating that crane like that?
Well, we're on 12 off 4. Uh-huh. And the crane inside, my crane had a bed. And I could climb on my bed, say I was on 12, and I would say I'd work 10 straight hours. And I'd get a break. Maybe something, your truck would be broke down or they weren't doing something. And I'd climb in my bed, and I'd sleep. Mm-hmm. And my stevedore, Filipinos, come up and shake me. Hey, boss, you got a truck. And so I'd get up, and I'd go back and climb in the seat, and then I'd unload. Sometimes you go 4, 5, 6 hours straight again before you got a break. So some days I wouldn't get out of that cab for other than to go to the bathroom. That was the only reason I'd get out of there. Sometimes you didn't even get out to take a leak. You just stood and peed over the side. We had a condition 2 hurricane coming in. They said to move all equipment back into a cove. And I said, I can't move this crane back there. And they said, you're given order to move that crane. Get it out of here, you know. So I got up on the track, and I blocked the whole track. Nobody could pass me or get around me, you know. And I had traffic backed up way behind me. And finally, I got to a point where they pulled me off the track and let the rest of them go by. But I blocked the whole, everybody from getting up to where they're supposed to be going with it.
And they're trying to all get out of the path of a typhoon before it's too late. So what happened when the typhoon hit?
It never hit.
Ah.
We just had a lot of wind, you know, of wind. And when you're in the crane, you know, there's no windshield and there's no glass in the doors or anything. And the wind blowing, you're taking it right straight in your face, you know.
Oof.
And round the clock. But it was 120 to 124 degrees in that crane.
Well, and I'm thinking about all the veterans I've had the privilege of meeting who served in the Pacific during these times, and specifically in the Philippines. And you just mentioned one of the potential hazards, the weather. The typhoons at times were devastating. Certainly the enemy, there's the potential for a bomber coming over or, you know, an air raid or getting shelled or whatever. And then the other one would be illness. disease, malaria, dengue, all the different things that went through, beriberi, any of those hazards that you had to deal with?
I had malaria. I went in December the 26th into the hospital. In the hospital, there were three Quonset huts. The center Quonset hut was for first aid. The upper Quonset hut was for VD. The bottom Quonset hut was malaria. And malaria, where I was sent to, or taken to, had two beds side by side. And on each bed had a rubber mat. And you laid on that one bed and went through a sweat with malaria. I had falciparum malaria, which malaria, there I found out later on, there are four grades. The top grade is fatal. The second grade, falciparum, which is I have. The third grade is like flu. And the fourth grade is more or less like you got a real head cold. So I had falciparum. Temperature was 106 degrees.
Holy moly.
And I was laid on the bed on the rubber sheet, no covers on at all, and go through a sweat. And then when I'd start getting chills, they would roll me on the other bed, cover me all up with all kinds of blankets and everything they could. It took two corpsmen to pick up the rubber sheet and pour the water off. It had that much water. I was that way for 6 days, and I still never ever remember drinking any water or even feeding me or anything. I have no idea what I did for 6 days. And they brought a doctor in from Philippines, from Manila, and he looked at me and he said, "Wow," he said, your chart shows you 106 degrees, you're dead. He said, "If you go to 107, he said, you won't make it." So the next day I went to 105, and I stayed, and I came, that was about 105, 104, somewhere near my temperature, and I heard this bugle blowing. And I asked the coroner, "What's that?" He said, "It's New Year's Eve." And from the 26th until the 31st, I was in sick bay, not knowing who I was. When I finally got released, the commander of the base, because I was the only crane operator they had for the big crane, and he says, he called me Johnson or Doug, one or the other, either way. He says, "You got anybody can run that crane?" And I said, "Not that I know of." I said, "I got a friend of mine, pretty sharp." And I said, "His name is Egnatuck. We call him Eggy." And he says, "Can you train him?" And I says, "Yeah." And he says, "Okay, I'm assigning you a Jeep and a driver. You're on limited duty until I tell you what." So I got Eggy, and I taught him the operation of the crane and everything. And it took me damn near 2 full months to get him to learn the picking it up, you know, and your counterweights and swinging back and forth and everything.
How long did it take you to recover from that bout with malaria?
Well, I really got over it. It seemed like pretty well. I got my appetite back and everything, but I lost a tremendous amount of weight. I weighed 206 pounds, and I wound up at 158.
Wow. And how long were you over there in the Philippines?
I went in there on 1944 in July, and I left in May of 46. When I was at Tacloban, there's an airstrip there belonging to the U.S. Air Force. I was part of a work detail, and I could drive truck. So I drove a 10-wheeler, and I would go past the airstrip down to the far end, and they would load 500-pound bombs in cases on the back of my truck. Now, on a 500-pound bomb, on the front of the bomb is a propeller, and the propeller is all the way in with clips on it. And when they get ready to drop that, they cut the wire on the clips, and as that bomb would go down, the propeller would unscrew and set the detonator off when it hit the ground. All the bombs that we had had the wires clipped. So we had those bombs in cases to move in our trucks. They didn't shift or anything. It didn't really scare us, because if one went off, you wouldn't know it anyway. But I mean, it didn't scare us. And we took it down to the jetty, and then they would offload it at the jetty with cherry pickers. I did that for 1 week. Then the next week, I was reassigned the library. And so I was working in the library, and we heard this big boom. And what happened was one of the big 500-pound bombers went off on the jetty.
Oh, wow.
And killed 42 guys.
Wow.
And
that could have been you.
Well, it could have been trucks or something. You know, you don't know who was where or what, you know.
Had you been driving that truck and you hit a pothole or something?
You could have.
Yeah. So you had a photograph in your locker the entire time you were in the Pacific?
Oh, yeah.
What was on that photograph?
I had a picture of Marianne and my sister, Pat. It was a 5x7 picture.
So it was a picture of two high school tennis players.
Yeah.
Your sister, Pat, was one of them, and you really didn't know who the other one was.
Didn't know her by name, no. It's nor she had white shorts on.
And how often did you see that picture while you were overseas?
Whenever you opened her, you know, because our lockers were like trunks.
Uh-huh.
In Quonset huts, and you'd open her up under there.
Yeah.
So I never thought about her because I had no girlfriends. And
yeah.
All the guys in the barracks that I was, the Quonset hut they were in, finally at the end, Quonset hut they were in, we only had one married guy, and the rest of the guys had girlfriends. They'd get letters from her. They wouldn't get letters from her.
Is this the only picture you had in your locker?
At that time, that was the one I carried for 2,000 miles. Had stayed with it when I got home. I met her at her home. And she didn't know who I was, and I told her I was Pat's brother. And she says, oh, you're Doug. And I said, yeah, I'm Doug. And so we talked for about a half an hour. And I said, would you like to go to Carnation and have a milkshake or something? And she said, yeah, let's do that. And her boyfriend was in the living room while we were visiting.
How did he feel about that?
I don't know.
And when did you figure out that she was the same girl in the picture?
My sister Pat told me who it was, but never gave me her name. I didn't know her name.
But when you saw her in the flesh, you said, hey, that's the girl that was in that picture?
It looks like, I said, I've seen you before, I said. She said, no, you have not seen me before. So that's how we met. And that was just prior to Christmas in 1946. It was just before Christmas because I went over and got a check for work that I did for her dad.
And how long was it before you two were married?
A year we were engaged, and then the following year we were married. I only had $1,200, so that was all the money I had. And I was, at that time, I was building a theater at Biola, so I was pretty well occupied.
And 73 years later, you're still married.
Still married, and she now has become more of a boss than she was a wife in the past. You know, yes, dear, no, dear, but now it's hey, you.
For those of us who would love to be able to say someday, yes, we've been married 73 years, what wise, sage advice can you share with us if we want to make it 73 years like you two have?
Well, I would say I would have to put her in a category of equal because I had no advantage over her on her ability, and she could do anything I could do and sometimes better. So all through our farming, through the building, she took care of three children. Some days when we're working on a job close by, she would come over with a new dress that she had made, and all three kids, two shirts on the boys, and the daughter had a new dress. And so she'd walk in on the job, and there were the three kids and her. So, you know, you have to admire somebody to be able to do that. So I would say she's of equal, maybe a little bit plus.
Have you ever looked at this picture?
Oh, many, many, many times.
And considered what the probability was that while you were sitting there in the Philippines as a crane operator in the Navy, looking at this picture of your sister, that the mysterious girl next to her would be your wife someday? I mean, what are the odds of that?
Never thought of that. No, I never did. I really didn't call on her. I called on her dad to get my check. And that's when I saw her.
Well, and I don't want to leave anything out. You know, if there's some other stories that come to mind, feel free to share them. But I also, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a story that we've never heard before.
You know, I tell you what, the way I feel personally, and I appreciate the thank you, but I feel personally I was a civilian farmer, and I helped grow crops were used in the defense. And then when I went in the service, I admired the people that built the planes and the tanks and the guns and the bullets. Where would we have been? And at that time, I thought there were over 11 million in the service. Where would we have been without the civilian dedication? A lot of women worked in airplanes. When I've been down to Quartzsite, and that was a woman's air base down there that they ferried the pilots to the East Coast. The women were just as important as the men, and they welded aboard ships and they did everything. So without the civilians and the dedication that they had, they were as important to me as my job. All I was doing was stacking what they had built.
And, you know, a lot of times people will talk, they will compare World War II to conflicts that have occurred since. And I think you can make the case that what you just hit on is the most glaring difference, that we haven't had a war since World War II where the entire nation was united behind an effort and doing what they could on the home front the way they did then.
Everywhere, even in farming, you know, we had at Biola, we had a lookout tower. And I think her mother was on the lookouts. They stand up in the tower with their binoculars, and every plane that flew over, they knew what was going on or something, and they would report it accordingly. So even the housewives that didn't weld or hammer or do anything like that were dedicated to doing something in the service.
Sure.
So we fought a war of united people, and I think the United States of America really made a lot of sense when the word united. I fly the flag 24 hours a day for the simple reason that it represents the United States. And if we go back in time when they dedicated the Constitution and all the other things, the people that wrote the Constitution were thinking about other than themselves. The wrong thing I feel wrong with politicians today is they think of themselves first and what they can do second. And it's wrong.
I have one more question. I don't know if this is an easy question, but when you think of the 97 years you've spent on this planet, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, let's put it in a real simple way. I raised 3 kids along with my wife. We have 3 of what I consider the finest kids. They are all noted in what they do. I don't know of anything that makes a person more prouder of the wife that did the raising when I worked in construction than what I did teaching them farming. They all drove tractor probably before they're 8 years of age. All 3 kids come home when we have a dinner here with their families. We only have 21 people for dinner.
A blessing they enjoyed again this past week in celebrating their 73rd anniversary. You'll find a video of Doug and his wife Mary Ann on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and also at hometownheroesradio.com, where the podcast version of this episode contains additional material that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time today. Boy, that time has flown right by today. But thanks so much for listening, and thanks to the Johnsons for sharing a slice of their life with us. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.